Hello and welcome back to our spin-off show, Another 10 Questions. Today we're joined by former advertising copywriter turned social commentator turned novelist, Jane Carrow. It's impossible not to feel wiser after a conversation with Jane. If you suffer anxiety or insecurity or just want to turn your life around, then listen in. I first came across Jane on what used to be the Gruen Transfer, then invited her to be on Agony, and was immediately engaged by her clear thinking and the effortless way she gets her message across. Here, she talks about the days when being a feminist wasn't cool, how to freak out someone who's shouting at you, and the wisdom she was taught the morning after her daughter nearly died. But I start our chat by asking Jane how her co-workers would describe her.
People think, who don't know me, that I must be very difficult. Because a woman with an opinion is clearly very difficult. You know, it could not be possible that they were amenable. But actually, I'm not particularly difficult to work with. I've co-authored books very, very happily, you know, without any fights or any difficulties. And when I did have colleagues and co-workers when I worked in ad agencies, well, you know, most of the people that were my art directors when I was a writer, and you work in a team in an ad agency, are my friends now. So I presume they, you know, say reasonably nice things about me. Generally, I think I enjoy collaborating. I enjoy, as I was just telling you before, I've just finished a novel, and you know, I love the editing process. I actually really like the feedback that comes from an editor, even if it's, as it often is, you know, there's a lot more work to be done and there are things that aren't right and aren't working. And, you know, editors are very skilled at telling you that without annihilating you. But even so, I really do enjoy getting advice, getting help, listening to other people's ideas. And, you know, I never mind whose idea it is. I always just want the end result to be really good. And if the other person has a better idea than me, then that's fine. You know, let's go with that one. I long ago gave up the idea that everything I did, I had to be the star of. I remember when I first started appearing on television, you know, say The Gruen or something, I just used to think to myself, I just go on, I'll be myself and I'll say what I think. I'm not trying to be the cleverest. I'm not trying to be the funniest. I'm not trying to be the most outrageous. I'm just trying to be me, as much me as I can be. And I've kind of kept doing that. And, of course, there are people who don't like me. I mean, that's fair enough. Nobody has to like me. But I think it makes you fairly easy to deal with because you're not in that bizarre narcissistic competition as to who's the winner.
Yeah,
it's more about being part of producing whatever it is that you're trying to produce to the best possible standard that you as a group can manage. So that's the way I've tried to approach things.
I think you've hit on something there. The notion that if you're being honest and yourself, that you are going to be easy to deal with. Because there's none of that anxiety of lying there. You know, if you're kind of putting on a character or you're not actually representing yourself truthfully, then you're probably going to be a little bit on edge.
Yeah, and I think second guessing is always a waste of time. If you spend your time, I make speeches for a living, or I did before COVID, and people often say to me, aren't you afraid of standing up in front of an audience? You know, because so many people are terrified of making a speech, and I'm not at all. And I said no, because I know what I can control and what I can't. I can control what I say and I can control the way I come across, you know, the things that I do, my gestures, the way I speak, and the ideas that I put forward. How the audience responds to it is entirely up to them. That's within their control. I can't control that. So I don't workshop things. I don't try to second guess what an audience might like. I think, what do I want to say? Obviously, I like to find out who's in the audience, like, you know, what sort of people and what they're interested in, and I try to think of things that will have some relevance. But I'm not trying to please them or tell them what I think they want to hear or challenge them or any of that nonsense. I'm just trying to say what I think as honestly as I can and leaving their responses up to them. And that seems to work quite well too. And it takes the fear away because I always think to myself, I'm only ever talking to an audience of one. I'm not talking to a multi-hydra-headed monster of, you know, 200 or 1,000 people, depending on how many people are in the audience, because that's when people get themselves all twisted up. And I think that idea of second guessing and trying to be what other people want you to be and trying to control the response to your work, whether it's a speech or an ad or a novel or a comedy show or a podcast, is what gets us into trouble, because then we stop being ourselves and we stop authentically expressing our own thoughts and opinions and start to try and please other people. And, you know, you're going to get shit on you anyway, whatever you do. Certainly if you're an out and proud feminist in today's world, you definitely will. Well, you may as well get shat on for your own mistakes. As for other people's, you know, that's much worse. So it does free you up a lot, and I think it does make you relatively easy to deal with because people, you know, they know what they're going to get with you. And you don't have another agenda, which you're not talking about, because the thing I always found hardest when I was working, you know, in offices and for other people was when you were told on a project that this is the agenda, and then as you worked on it, you discovered, oh, no, that was the politically acceptable agenda, but it's not actually the real agenda. The real agenda is something no one's actually talking about, and it's your job to find out what it is. Those were the worst jobs. They were the hardest things to do.
I bet. So that leads into question two. What's the most unhelpful feedback you've received?
There's been so much. Well, the first was when my mother told me never to learn to type. She meant it very well. She was a secretary. She should have been an historian, but she was born in 1931, and that wasn't really seen as an option for smart young girls in, you know, back then. So she ended up as a secretary in an office. And when she had her daughters and was always a feminist, my mother, from as long as I can remember, and she would always say to us, whatever you do, don't learn to type, because if you learn to type, that's what men will make you do. They'll make you type their things. And I think for her generation, that was probably excellent advice. For mine, it turned out to be an absolute disaster. Nobody types for me. I'm an absolutely dreadful, you know, two or three finger typist to this day. So that was a bad piece of advice. But another one was when a boss of mine, who's a lovely guy, this is in advertising, he's a lovely man, but his feedback was, you know what, Jane, you're really quite talented. This is when I was working as a copywriter. Now, he didn't say for a woman, but it was kind of unspoken because there weren't a lot of us. You're really quite talented, and if you just drop all this feminist stuff, you could really go quite far.
Oh, my God.
And I said to him, this would be in the 90s, I'd say, and I said to him, you know what, I can't drop the feminist stuff even if I wanted to, because that's the point of why I'm trying to get ahead. You know, like that's what I'm doing it for. That's what drives me on. And why it was such bad advice is now I look at a lot of the men that, you know, I was competing with back in advertising agency creative departments in the 80s and 90s and 2000s. And most of them now, you know, we're in our 60s, my peers and I, are eking out a living, you know, doing a bit of freelance work if they're lucky. And I'm on the telly and doing this podcast with you, Adam, and writing books. And why? Because I'm a feminist.
Yeah.
It's feminism that saved me. So that was really a really bad piece of advice, and I'm really, really glad I didn't take it. I wish I'd learned to type as well.
I've interviewed you a bunch over the years, and I think probably the first time was maybe 2013, and things have changed so dramatically since then. All those, you know, all those men with their opinions dated almost overnight. Did you find that, or was it just always a slow moving beast?
No, I found it exactly as you describe it, and it's made me think that we never know what the next thing is that's going to happen, because we're actually not very good at seeing the needle, if you like, move. It can feel like nothing's happening. And I spend like quite a lot of my time talking to people like, oh, you know, I've been fighting for whatever, like public education and things like that. And I feel like it's useless and hopeless. Climate change the same. You know, there's a lot of causes that people put an enormous amount of energy and effort and everything into, and they get very disheartened because they feel like nothing's changing. And I say to them, well, I've been a feminist for, you know, as long as I can remember. And for most of those decades, it felt like very little was changing. And everything that did change came with such effort and was so exhausting to push through. But now it's just gone exactly as you said. It's like we reached this tipping point and boom. And I do put a lot of that down to the hash me too moment in 2017, because what I think happened then was that so many millions of women suddenly spoke about things they'd never told anyone. And that the scales fell from our eyes, in that what we did was we looked at one another and said, what, you too? Like, this happened to everyone? It didn't just happen to me. I didn't just do something. It wasn't something about me that made that guy do that to me. It was something about just I was a woman, and it happens to almost every woman who's ever been born and ever lived. This is outrageous. And so we suddenly realized how comprehensively we'd been conned. And I don't think we're ever going back to being conned like that again. And that really proved what feminism had been arguing for, let's say, 300 years. And so it went from being, I mean, it's really interesting with the books I'm writing now. I first wrote a book with feminist in the title in, I think, about 2009, and hardly sold. And in those days, feminist in the title was the kiss of death, according to publishers. Now they're all desperate to put feminist in the title because it sells like, you know, bucket loads.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So, and it's women who are hungry to find out more. It's like they've been released from this idea that I think they always on some level kind of thought was a bit dodgy, but they thought they were the only person who thought it was a bit dodgy. And when you think you're the only person who thinks like that, you think, well, I'm probably wrong. You know, if everyone else thinks differently, then it's probably me that's wrong. But I think that's gone. Now women realize that they're not the only people who think like that or that that happened to. And so that gives you an enormous sense of confidence. Yes, this is real. I didn't make this up. It's almost like there was like centuries of gaslighting.
Exactly. I was just thinking that. Yeah.
It's occurring to every woman in the world, and they've suddenly recognized it for what it is. And I think this happened because of so many women plugging away for so long, even though it felt almost hopeless. And the message I keep trying to send is, it's never hopeless. Every bit you do adds to every bit everybody else has done, you know, and though it feels hopeless, it never is. Something fundamental will change if you keep going.
How do you feel about the factions within feminism from different perspectives of different generations?
I ignore them, basically. I don't get caught up in them. I don't like factions much on the left at all. I dislike seeing, you know, I watch the fights on Twitter about trans women and radical feminists, and I watch them about choice feminism and liberal feminism, and I watch them about a lot of other things too. It's not simply feminism, it's a whole lot of things. And I watch them fight and I just have one thought: wrong enemy.
Yeah.
Fighting the wrong people. These are not your enemy. You may have differences of opinion, you may think, you know, that something somebody said is wrong or the way they do it, but they're not your enemy. They're not the ones holding you back. And, of course, it suits the powerful enormously to watch those with little power fighting one another. That's the best outcome for them. Oh, so yes. I will not get involved in those fights. I will not. Terminology is not a big deal to me. I'm always thinking about what's the intent. If someone uses language badly but their intent is good, I will forgive them. If someone uses language beautifully but their intent is bad, I will not forgive them. That's so. You know, I just think we get caught up in things that we, and I understand why, because it's a lot less scary to fight people who are as powerless as you are. It's much easier to fight laterally and to do lateral damage than it is to fight those who really have power, because those who really have power, as a lot of people, a lot of women at the moment have discovered to their detriment, we've got defamation actions flying all over the place. Those who really have power, they can hurt you. They can damage you. That's the really scary fight. But that's the only fight worth having if what you want to do is redistribute power more fairly. So I ignore it all. I'll accept anyone as a feminist. who claims to be one, mm-hmm. just as I'll accept anyone as a woman who identifies as a woman. I accept you at your summation of yourself. I believe that's the fundamental of respect. Mm-hmm. But if the only people I won't accept as feminists who say they are feminists are those who oppose reproductive rights. I don't mind if they're against abortion for themselves. That's entirely their right. But if they want to change legislation to stop women, other women having abortions because they or their God thinks it's wrong, they're not feminists. That is the one line that I think you can't be a feminist and want other women to make their bodily autonomy lower than yours. Or conform to your view of what women should do with their body. I think that's the only line I would draw. Otherwise, if you're a conservative feminist, may not agree with your conservatism, but I'm certainly happy to accept you as someone who believes in equality for women.
That really resonated with me when you said it's so easy to fight laterally as opposed to actually fighting up. You know, there's so many examples of that where people just like, you know, similar beliefs turning on each other.
It's depressing when it happens. It's almost inevitable. I don't necessarily judge the people who do it because, you know, we all get frustrated, we get angry, and we lash out when we shouldn't. Families are the places where much fighting and damage happens. But I do like the saying, I think it was Catherine Deveney who used to say it, that the right eat other people's children, the left eat their own.
Yeah.
And I think there's real truth to that. We're idealistic, and sometimes that idealism can morph into a kind of didactic insistence on everybody saying using the same language or, you know, having – and I that sort of thing I don't get engaged with.
They argue the angles and the minutia.
Yeah.
What is the failure you most cherish?
Oh, what a very good question. What a very good question. I think it's all my failures I cherish, actually, because it's when I failed that I learnt. Obviously I like success as much as anyone else does and, you know, I enjoy people being flattering and saying nice things, and of course I do. I'm not without ego and vanity and all that kind of stuff. But if I think back over it, every single failure, painful, and some of them have been excruciatingly painful, as they were, that's when I was more alive. That's when I was more aware of things and more open to learning new ways of doing and being and growing. When I'm successful, sometimes I feel like I'm floating through life a bit. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not actually, it's the tough times where you feel that you're really living. But I'd say, I make lots of failures. I say stupid things. Often I tweet when I shouldn't. Exactly. But sometimes I think that's why people quite like me too. I think you're always controlled and perfect. That's worse. Well, anyway, I would say that because it couldn't possibly be that. So that's my rationalization. But probably the biggest failure I had was when I was fired, when I was 4 months pregnant. I'd managed as a young copywriter in the 80s to, and women copywriters were very rare at that time. I only got in because of nepotism, because at the time that I was trying to get a job, my father was he had control of the largest advertising budget in Australia as a client, so it was pretty easy for me to get a job. And I managed to get eventually a job in a creative department, thanks to Bryce Courtney, amongst others. It was nice of him. He encouraged my talent, what he saw as a nascent talent, which was good of him. And I managed to get ahead and to win some awards. And it was always hard because as a female copywriter then, I was very quickly aware that I was always seen as a risky investment. They weren't sure that women could cut it. You know, there just was this basic prejudice. Oh, I think it still exists. I still think my view of things is white, straight, and particularly private school educated men are assumed to have talent until they prove otherwise.
Mm.
No one else is assumed to have talent. They are assumed not to have talent until they prove otherwise. So there's, we're in the negative trying to prove ourselves. They're in the positive. And that's why so many Nongs get ahead, because they're given credit just for looking and sounding right.
Yeah, yeah.
And that, you know, we see that all the time. So I had to battle with that. But I got myself into the hottest agency as a young creative in the hottest agency in Australia at the time, a writer, middleweight writer at Campaign Palace.
Ah.
And I they paired me up with another woman, terrific, talented, lovely woman, but the two of us were in a sort of hot, cold sweat all the time trying to prove that we deserved the job. And after about 2.5 years, I was 4 months pregnant, they lost a major account and they fired both of us. And that was pretty devastating because, I mean, you get fired all the time in advertising. It's not as big a stigma as it is in other forms of business, or then, now, of course, everyone gets fired all the time. But
yeah, yeah.
In the 80s, it was a little bit less likely to happen. But I couldn't get another job and I was really out of the business for about 5 years, and I really did feel as if I'd failed and that I'd never get back into writing.
Mm.
And I was at home with small children and I got a bit of freelance. So I couldn't just be I love my children, but being a mother is, let me be honest with you, it's drudgery, really.
Yeah,
and
right.
Bored and
yeah.
Sobless. So I retrained at that point as a relationships counselor. I did a course at night and retrained. Wow. And I got to the end of that course. I passed and everything. And I could have got a placement with maybe Marriage Guidance or Unifam or one of the counselling agencies, but I couldn't fit it in around my parenting duties because my husband got a job where he was travelling all the time, so it just became impossible. So I'm a trained relationships counsellor who's never practised, and maybe that sounds like I wasted my time, but, oh, my God, I have found that training, particularly the counselling training, so learning how to hear what people are saying beneath the words they're saying, you know, how to paraphrase and play back to people to get them to clarify. When I've done interviewing on radio or in the documentaries that I've made, or even running panels, you know, for conferences or writers' festivals, that training I got during that period of my life where I felt I was a failure, has stood me in the most enormous stead. Like I almost see it as one of the most valuable things I ever did. And so that came directly out of when I thought I'd failed. And I did end it. I fully intended to go and work in counselling, and I thought I'd maybe do a psychology degree or something as well. But I got offered a job back in copywriting out of the blue when my youngest child started preschool. And I took that.
Oh,
and
my God.
That was great too. Yeah.
So how long was this course? Was it like a year or something? A
couple of years, I think. A
couple of years.
Yeah.
And so you essentially hear the subtext of what people are saying, you know.
Well, I've been trained to listen. It doesn't mean I always do it, but certainly if I'm in an interview situation, so I'm interviewing somebody, I will always listen for the clues that may not just be the substance of what they say. And I've learnt that if I want to get more out of someone, instead of saying, can you tell me more about that, it's better to say, so you're saying, and paraphrase, because almost always they'll come back to you saying, well, I'm sort of saying that, but I'm also saying this. And then they give you all that lovely stuff.
Fantastic.
That they haven't actually said. And it also enables me, I was trained to put myself in my subject's shoes. So I'm always there with the person I'm interviewing. So, like, for example, recently at a writer's festival, well, it was pre the latest COVID lockdown, I was asked to interview Tanya Plibersek. She put together a book of essays about what the world should look like after COVID. And I've met Tanya quite a few times and everything, but I thought she was quite nervous before we went on. And I can understand that. If you're a politician, it's a different thing than being a writer when you get on stage, even at a writer's festival, even about a book you put together. You know, you're always surrounded by enemies. You're always surrounded by people who, and you live in a world where it's all about, you know, scoring a point against the enemy and getting ahead and being smarter, faster, quicker, you know. And so I think she was nervous. Well, I was pretty sure she was nervous. So I just went into my, you know, make the person feel comfortable, make them feel safe and warm, and then your whole job is to simply get them to be themselves and tell you about what we're talking about. And the safer they feel with you, the more and more interesting information you will get. It's not a trick. You're not trying to make them say things they don't want to say or embarrass themselves. It's simply a way of really building a safe place for that person to feel they're really talking to you. And I was trained to do that. I mean, that's just such an, and I'd never know, I would never have known how to do that intuitively. You know, it is a skill. It's called active listening. And I'm lucky enough to know how to do it when it's appropriate. And it's just made a big difference. Lots of people will say to me at the end of it, oh, you handle that so well. I had another writer's festival I was at, there was a lovely older man I was interviewing about his memoir, and he got very distressed talking about it. And now a lot of people, when an interview subject gets really distressed, panic. And they want to stop the distress. Because I train as a counsellor, I don't panic. I assume that distress is something people can cope with. And if they get distressed, that's okay. It's not my fault. I didn't cause the distress. They have come... they're talking about something that they feel very strongly about, and that to sit with them in that distress and not panic about it, not want to shut them down or gloss over it, because all of those are kind of about me, my discomfort, not about how the person who is talking's feeling. And I was, you know, it worked very well, and the person, the distress was appropriate to what the memory that they were talking about. It was a memoir. And the interview went extremely well. And somebody afterwards said to me, thank you for handling that. So, and I said, well, I sort of cheated because I got trained to do that a long time ago.
Yeah, that's really great advice.
Yeah, and so it's all, it's very simple stuff, but you have to, you know, it's like anything simple. You do need to learn it, that you can't just do it. And that was such a wonderful experience. And far from being wasted, even though I never actually went to work in the field in which I had trained.
That's brilliant. That's brilliant. Yeah, I'd love to be able to. I find myself panicking sometimes. I know exactly what you're talking about there. When someone's crying during an interview or something, I want to reach out and make them feel better. And you're right. It's about me. It suddenly becomes about me then.
It's exactly right. You want to calm. The first thing you're taught in counselling is, it's never about you and how you're feeling. If you're the counsellor, the interviewer, the facilitator, it's never about you and how you're feeling. It's always about the interviewee and where they're at, and you follow them. You follow them and you stay at their pace and you just speak and ask them. And if they don't, you trust them too. You trust their strength and respect their strength, because some people think, oh, you know, I could ask them a question that might upset them. No, you'll ask them a question. As long as your intent's good. If you're being aggressive and nasty, well, yes, you might. But if your intent is good, then if they don't want to answer the question, they will say to you, oh, I don't want to answer that, or no, that's not how it was. And that's absolutely fine. You then follow their direction.
That's right. This next question, I mean, it doesn't take into account COVID, but if you could go back 5 years, what advice would you give yourself?
Patience. Be patient. You never know what's going to happen. And you're going to lose a lot of what you had, but you're not going to mind that much, which is not something I would have thought. And partly that's because everybody lost a lot. It's not like you were Robinson Crusoe. And so I think it's a common experience that people have lost a lot of things they thought they had. Income, social life, opportunities, you know, but we've all learnt that actually that doesn't kill you. you can survive that and you can remain quite buoyant. I mean, yes, you'll feel disappointed about things, and some people have lost a lot more than I have. So I'm just speaking from that perspective. But also that you will then find something else to do that will, you know, push you to try things you never would have dreamt of trying. And that would be, I wrote the book during COVID, and I don't know that I would have had the courage to do that if I was running around doing all the other things I used to do as well. So, yeah, I think I'd say, as with anything, most experiences turn out to be better than you thought they'd be. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know COVID was coming like 5 years ago, but nevertheless, I would say that. Don't worry, be patient. Most experiences turn out to be better than you think they're going to be. Most fear, most dread, most anxiety is anticipation.
Did you have that the idea for the book lurking in your head pre-COVID?
Yes. I'd had the idea, and I told a couple of people about it, and they'd encouraged me to find a literary agent, which I did do. But it was only, and it was another failure actually that pushed me into starting to actually get pen to paper, because you can have lots of ideas. It's actually, doing something about them. And I'd written another novel. I first wrote it in 2012, and then I put it aside to do something else. And then I went back to it and rewrote it again. And then my publisher, it was a young adult novel, my publisher didn't like it and basically rejected it. And so that was a big blow and a big failure. But I had this other idea in my head, and I thought, well, this is the previous novel, this is disappointing, but I'll just go and write this. And so if I hadn't failed at that first novel, I probably, well, it wasn't my first, but anyway, the previous novel, I probably wouldn't have started this one. And so far it hasn't been published yet, so we haven't had general readers' verdict, but so far, the publisher, the editor, the people who've read it all really like it. So, again, fantastic. Out of a failure comes something else that probably was a better idea in the first place.
I guess this dovetails into the next question. What about your job keeps you awake at night?
Well, what keeps me awake at night, I think, is the thing that keeps most writers awake. Not necessarily. Well, it's certainly with novels, yes, but with shorter form, when you're writing about important issues like education or the cashless debit card or whatever it is you're writing about, is the terrifying fear that you've misquoted or you've got a fact wrong or you've misunderstood something, and you wake up at 2 a.m. just before it goes, you know, live the next day and think, oh, shit, I should have checked that quote with so-and-so before I put, oh, shit, you know.
Yeah.
It's that horrible thought. And so far it's never actually blown up in my face, but I cannot tell you the number of times I've woken up at 2 or 3 a.m. and gone, fuck.
Yeah.
Like, I ring that person and check that quote for the third time, and, you know, what if they get upset about this, and am I sure those numbers are right? You know how terrible you are at maths. You know, that kind of thing. That's what it, and it's, it's short-term anxiety. It blows. I've often found the worst time ever in 24 hours is 2 to 3 a.m. if you're awake, and things blow up to huge proportions, and then eventually I manage to talk myself down and go back to sleep. When I wake in the morning, I think to myself, what the fuck was I worrying about that for?
Yeah, it's interesting. Well, I have had cause to worry. I wasn't involved in a story, but I was blamed for a story that went wrong at the Herald Sun. And the headline was Two Dead in Bendigo Siege. Only one was dead. And the guy, the other guy who was named as being dead, rang to say that he wasn't dead. And they blamed me, but it wasn't me. It was someone trying to kind of wriggle out of it. But I had to actually, you know, I was called in front of everyone to ensure that I wasn't involved in the story. But yeah, two dead.
It's hideous. I remember being involved, and it happens all the time. I remember being involved. Fortunately, I wasn't involved in the ad, but it was I think it was our agency. I can't remember now. But they showed footage. They had hardly any money to do an ad for Telstra or someone like that about how we help in emergencies, one of those. And they went to stock footage and they got a piece of footage of a girl in a flood, you know, very dramatic. Just chopped in with a whole lot of other stuff or edited in. And then it turned out that it was from America and the girl had died. And, oh, my God, the shit hit the fan. People got fired, you know. Oh, it was a nightmare. And this poor editor and creative team, they'd just been trying to do their best with, you know, $3.50.
Yeah.
And I felt sorry for them. But, you know, and that and those kinds of slip-ups can happen. You know, people aren't perfect. Things, when you're frantic, they get through to the keeper and, you sold footage in good and you buy it in good faith thinking it's fine, yeah. And then it turns out not to be. And so, yes, I mean, I wake up in a cold sweat about things like that sometimes, and I get very comforted when I read journalists and writers who I admire saying something similar. I think, oh, thank God, I'm not the only one.
Yeah, you're in a public industry. Mm. What's an obstacle you've had to overcome?
Oh, being a woman. Yeah, being a woman primarily. I often think, what would my career have been like if I'd been born a boy? I think it would have been very different. I think I would have earned a lot more money. I think I would have risen a lot higher in the advertising industry. But that's not something I regret, actually. I also don't think I would have ended up with the kind of bizarre kind of career that I've had over the last 15 years, which I've loved. So it was a big barrier. It was difficult to overcome. And I think it also gave me opportunities, and that's almost always what barriers do. People I know who got a totally smooth ride from an early age, and perhaps that's what would have happened to me as a white, straight, privileged man, had that been what I was, I would have had a smooth ride. That can be really difficult when things go downhill because you don't actually know how to cope with that. You've never had problems. Whereas I think for other people, you're always overcoming barriers, and in the end, it's that that leads you into doing something you never thought you would be able to do, and perhaps gives you the grit and to some extent the desperation to give it a go.
So you left advertising did you leave advertising in 2006?
I think so, yeah, it was 2006. And it was because lovely Adam Boland at Sunrise, I was working in an agency I hated. It was the only agency I went to for the money, and I should never have done it. Never take a job for the money. There's a reason they have to pay you so much to go there. Mm-hmm. And I hated it. It was miserable. I called it the sad place, and my daughters remember that. And I got, I used to appear on Sunrise occasionally making comments about things, and Adam Boland rang me up and said, I want you to analyse the news for me every morning on Sunrise. I said, are you going to pay me? Because they'd never paid me before. And they said, yes, Jane, because I'm going to pay you. I said, oh, okay. And it was very little money in comparison to the money I'd been earning at the agency. It was a ridiculous amount, but it was only for like 3 hours in the morning from 4:30 to 7 in the morning. And I said to my husband, I've been offered this opportunity and I think I should take it, but the money's shit. He went, that's okay, we can manage. So I took it and I freelanced and stuff, and it only lasted 3 months. I wasn't very good at it. They also wouldn't give me my head. They wouldn't let me analyze the news papers the way I wanted to. They kept making me do it the way they wanted to, and learned those things never work. So it only lasted 3 months, and then he fired me. Which was sad, but not that bad actually. And then I thought, well, you know what? I don't want to go back in an agency. I'm going to see what I can do. And so I just started seeing what I could do. And turned out there was quite a lot of opportunities out there.
That's great. Was Gruen, what year are we talking about when you actually made your appearance?
Yeah, Gruen was a couple of years later, I think, maybe a few years later.
Right.
Because I kept, while they were, because what they were doing was they were auditioning lots of people in the industry, and they were looking for women because there weren't very many. And I kept getting people saying to me, I've given your name to Andrew Denton for this new show on advertising. You know, they'll get in touch with you. And they never did. And people said, oh, we should get in touch with him. But I'd made a little commitment. When I decided to take that chance and just go out there and see what was there, I said to myself, I'm not going to pester people for work. I'm people can find me fairly easily if they want me. I'm just going to sit and wait. I'm not going to go out there being pushy. You know, I didn't want to do that. And so I just said, no, I'm not going to contact them. If they want me, they can find me. And finally, I remember I got a phone call from John Casimir. And he said, what are you doing? And I said, well, I'm writing opinion pieces, and I think I'd written a couple of books by then, and, you know, appearing on Sunrise and doing this, that, and the next thing. And I said, but he said, yes, are you doing anything in advertising? I said, oh, yeah, I still do the occasional bit of freelance. And at that time I was lecturing in advertising creative. I was running the elective advertising creative in the communication arts degree at the University of Western Sydney. So that was the one kind of permanent job I had. It was only 2 days a week, but that's what I was doing. And he went, oh, great. He said, that's enough. He said, come in and do a workshop. So I came in and did a workshop, and they cast me in the show. And I was in the first episode. And, you know, it went on for quite a few years, but they sacked me in the end. I think it's partly because I wasn't really in advertising at all anymore, and I gave up the lecturing.
Yeah, you're right.
I was also getting on. You know, there is a problem. Women, there's never a sweet spot for women. You're always the wrong age. So when you're young, you're seen as, first of all, you don't know anything because you're young, and second of all, you could get pregnant any minute, and that'd be a problem. Then when you have had kids, well, of course, you're a pain in the neck because you're a parent, you've got children, and, you know, that's a complication. And then when you get to menopause and you're finally old, you know, you've graduated from being a life support system for other human beings, and you're full of energy and you've got all this experience is, oh, you're too old. Yeah. No one wants an old bat. So there's never a right age for a woman. You're always the wrong age. It doesn't matter what age you are, you're the wrong age. So I think that was part of it too. And I didn't mourn losing the analysing newspapers at Sunrise very much. I did mourn losing Brew, and I really enjoyed it. I still can't bring myself to watch it. Isn't that funny?
Yeah.
I just can't bear to watch it.
I was upset about that too, because I enjoyed watching you on Gruen. But we got your Nagini.
You did, and that was lovely. I really enjoyed that. That was very fun. And you gave me a lovely, lovely opportunity to speak about education, and I really enjoyed.
Oh, yeah, you were great.
Does paying for your child's education ensure a better academic performance?
No, we know it doesn't. We absolutely have all the facts. We know it doesn't. There is no correlation between who owns the school. This is across the world. No correlation between who owns the schools and the kinds of marks you're going to get. None whatsoever.
I was a bit horrified at how the rest of the panelists talked about it.
Except Dave O'Neill.
Yeah, except Dave O'Neill. I sometimes despair. Otherwise intelligent people do not understand about education at all and why it matters that every child gets...
Yeah, yeah.
An opportunity regardless of who their parents are. The same opportunity, as same as, you know, we can possibly do.
We have,
just don't seem to get it at all.
Yeah, we have gone backwards a significant way since Gough.
Jesus, it's like we only went forwards for a minute.
Yeah, that's right. What's the word or phrase you most overuse?
My husband just said, Yes, probably that. Absolutely, I say a lot at the moment. That drives people crazy.
Absolutely.
I think a lot of people are doing that. Yeah. I think that's, you know, I don't know that there's a lot of phrases that I'm aware of saying, but I do agree while I catch my thoughts.
Isn't it interesting? And when you're writing a book, did you notice that you might overuse a phrase in the book?
There were a couple that the editor brought up and said that I shouldn't, if I could make sure I cut some of those out. One of them was rolling your eyes, so I'd have them rolling their eyes a lot. But it's not a phrase I would use. That was describing what people do. I do roll my eyes a lot, so I'm not sure if we can count that. One of them, you know, she said, you've got your characters rolling their eyes all over the place. So I had to eliminate a lot of those. And I'd kept describing the villain of the piece as charming. So I may use charm, warmth, the words that are important to me.
Yep.
too much. And I have terrible habits of using worse as the beginning of a sentence. you know, I pile on the misery.
Yeah. How do you remain calm under pressure?
Yes, it's interesting. I don't think I was very good at that when I was young, but I've become much better at it as I get older, and I think maybe that is one of the things older people do get better at. Mm. I think part of it is listening hard to, because I usually find I'm under pressure when I'm in a situation where there's aggression. So it might be a panel or an argument or a discussion, something like on the drum or something like that, where someone's being, quite aggressive. Mm-hmm. Those kinds of things. I've just find that I sit and I listen quite carefully. I learned a trick, and that helps me hold my face, and it helps me formulate my response. One of the things that does also help me when I'm under pressure, and say, for example, on Twitter, if I'm involved in something there and people are having a go, is I long ago recognised that when people are nasty to me, and they particularly if they don't know me, then that has nothing to do with me. That's all about them. And I don't mind someone honestly disagreeing with me. That's perfectly fine. Of course you can disagree with me as if I know what's everything I don't. But when you go into personal attack and abuse, I find that actually quite easy to deal with, because as soon as that happens, I think, well, they haven't got any facts. They'll have to play me because they haven't got a good case.
Yeah.
So that's easy. And I've also learned, and I do give this advice to women online quite a lot, I've also learned that the way bullies work is they want to control your emotional reaction. So they want to make you feel humiliated, afraid, hurt, ashamed. You know, they want to evoke a negative reaction in whoever it is they're bullying.
Yes.
And what you must not do, you might feel those feelings, but what you must not do is let them see that. Mm. Don't ever let them see that. So because that's what they want, so don't give them what they want. And I think when I'm under pressure for whatever reason, I think to myself, don't give whoever's piling the pressure on what they want. And remember, you have the power to accept or reject this pressure. I know this is a ridiculous thing to quote from. You know, some people would quote from the Bible or Shakespeare, but no, I'm going to quote from Labyrinth, the film with David Bowie as the Goblin King.
Yes.
Where at the very end she unlocks the spell and gets her baby brother back, when she says, "You have no power over me." And that really resonated with me, because I think for a very long time in my youth I gave my power away. Women, it's very common in young women. We seek approval. We're constantly seeking to make sure that we're acceptable, we're approved of. And that's because we live in a dangerous world where just by being female we're not approved of. Mm. So we have to go around, and men have powers, so we have to keep them sweet, because otherwise they get very dangerous. So we spend a lot of our time giving our power away and trying to please others and trying to get approval. And very slowly I learned I'm not the sort of woman that's going to be approved of by a lot of people. So I have to stop seeking it, and I have to stop giving my power away. And so under pressure, I will often remind myself that I have the power.
Did your life change when you decided that?
Oh, yeah, very much so. Totally. I had an anxiety neurosis for many years as a young woman, really florid, quite, you know, I've written a book about it, my memoir is really all about that. And then I had an experience with my eldest daughter when she was born prematurely and caught RSV positive bronchiolitis, a respiratory disease you cannot vaccinate against.
Oh, wow.
Any anti-vaxxers out there? Baby daughter would not have nearly died. She stopped breathing in my arms 3 times, had to be rushed into intensive care, resuscitated, rushed into intensive care. It was extremely terrifying. But by that time, because of the anxiety neurosis and the fact that I'd sought treatment for it, I had developed the habit and the confidence that if I needed help, I asked for it. And so I reached out, and I was lucky enough to be put in contact with this amazing neonatologist who was also a grief counsellor. He was a grief counsellor because he'd lost a child of his own, who came and talked to me the morning after, you know, she'd stopped breathing and I was sure she was going to die. And she didn't, just to comfort everyone at this point. he came to see me, and he said these incredible three sentences to me, basically, that changed my whole view of the world for the rest of my life and that have stood me in good stead ever since. And they were, there's nothing special about you, and there's nothing special about Polly, my daughter. Terrible things can happen, and they can happen to anyone. Safety is an illusion. Danger is reality. Anti-vaxxers yearn for safety, predictability. They believe that if they're a good enough person and they eat enough kale, they'll never get sick and die. This is all fantasy. I learned this. It is fantasy. Let it go. Let it go. You're in danger all the time. That is the reality of life.
Yeah.
The weird thing about that was, once I accepted that and stopped trying to control everything, stopped trying to control the things I couldn't control, everything got better. My anxiety neurosis basically dissipated and eventually disappeared altogether. And I became able to go and try all sorts of things and do all sorts of things, because I kept thinking, well, you know, maybe I'll fail, maybe I'll be humiliated, maybe it'll be awful, but who cares? That could happen anyway. Yeah. I may as well give it a burl. and things like, if I was on a plane, I stopped doing the magical thinking about, you know, oh, if I only do this or that or the next thing, then this plane won't crash. I went, oh, this plane could crash, but it's not my job to keep it in the air, and I can't anyway. I'm not the pilot. I'm just a passenger. I'm just going to sit here, and if it starts to plummet, I'll worry about it then. But up until then, I'm going to enjoy the wine, the food, and the, you know, entertainment. And so far, so good. And that's when I learned that most fear and dread and anxiety is anticipation. It's you anticipating disaster. When disaster actually strikes, it's funny, you can cope with it. It's the anticipation of disaster, when you haven't got anything to cope with, the fear of the disaster, that totally fucks you up. And if you let go, I'm always saying to my daughters, in fact, this is the word I overuse, my daughters would definitely say this, they would say, oh, this is mum's word, don't anticipate. Whenever they're telling me about, I'm going to fail this exam, I'm going to do this, this is going to happen, I'm not going to get this job I want, I'm not, blah, 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 whatever it is, I just say, don't anticipate. Just go for it. Maybe it'll happen, maybe it won't.
That's great. You
don't anticipate.
You did mention before something about a trick about having, like, when you're on television and there's an argument going on and you don't reveal your face. And
well, it was a trick I learned, again, because I was ticked off about doing something wrong. When I was first on Sunrise, and they used to have the monitor, as you would know for being on television, particularly live television, they always have a monitor where you can see yourself. Well, when you're first on television, it's a bit hard to look away from it. So I got into trouble, probably from Adam Boland, for looking at the monitor. Don't look at the monitor. And I thought, how the bloody hell am I not going to look at the monitor? And I thought, I know what I'll do. I'll look at whoever's speaking. So I just developed this habit of whoever was talking, I just fixed my eyes on them and didn't move my eyes and really paid attention to them, or just kept my face on them. And many years later, somebody said to me, you know, I don't always agree with what you say on television, but you know what impresses me? I love the way you really listen. Actually, all I was trying to do was avoid looking at the monitor, but it paid off really well.
Well, that's right. It's an acting trick too, by the way.
Exactly. And also it works when someone's giving you a hard time. You just look at them very, very, if they're talking, and you just look at them unflinchingly, and they will find that quite confronting if you're looking at them quietly, not pulling a face or anything, while they're having a go at you. And it also enables you to hold on to your own power. I am not reacting to this. I am not getting upset. I am not going to allow you to do what you want to do, which is to make me get defensive or flustered or aggressive in response. I'm not going to do any of those things, which doesn't mean I never will. Sometimes I fail. But that's okay as well.
That's great advice. career high and career low for you?
Oh, career high. There's been a few. I suppose really the career high, as silly and sort of vain of me to say this, was when I won the Walkley in 2018 for women's leadership in the media. That was a real career high.
Yeah.
I really did never expect it to win a Walkley. I mean, I've won advertising awards, but I'd never expected to win a Walkley. I've never called myself a journalist. Like, I don't think of myself as a journalist. I'm not trained as a journalist. I call myself a social commentator and a writer, which I think is different from a journalist. Though I have done some journalistic style articles and I enjoy doing them, but I'm not a trained journalist. And so when I won that Walkley, I really did feel like I'd been accepted in a profession that I've always admired very much. And also I was extremely delighted to win it for women's leadership, because I suppose that I didn't necessarily aim to be a leader of women. I didn't do that, but I did aim to do whatever I could to advance the cause of women, and in the area in which I have some skill, which is words. And so that was really a career highlight.
Can I ask, was it based on a bunch of opinion pieces you'd done? Or which ones were they?
Oh, Christ, I can't remember. I'd have to go back and look at
But it was like three or four, were they?
Yeah. It was and written in between 2017 and 2018. I think one was for the Saturday paper where I looked at Hillary Clinton at that time, because it was 2018 and she'd lost the election to Trump. And I was so infuriated by the lock her up chance. And I sort of investigated how many female leaders of countries had been accused of corruption, jailed for corruption, or lost their job for corruption. And I found that out of only 10% of countries in the last 50 years have had a female leader. That means 90% have not. And of that tiny number of female leaders, fully one quarter, 25%, been accused of corruption, jailed for corruption, or lost the leadership because of accusations of corruption. And I thought to myself, how can this be true? Even Julia Gillard, do you remember all those accusations about the slush under Gordon later? And I wrote a piece looking at all these women, I wasn't saying none of them were corrupt, but what I was saying is it really true that a quarter of this tiny number of women? And my conclusion was that we see women who seek power in their own right as intrinsically suspicious. We're suspicious of that. Hillary Clinton had a 69% approval rating when she was Obama's Secretary of State. People loved her as a 2IC. We loved female Julia Gillard, most popular person in Parliament when she was the 2IC, Kevin Rudd. But as soon as women put their hand up for the top job, we hate them.
It's interesting.
Think there's something deeply wrong with them, and so any accusation will stick. We're prepared to think that they are corrupt, that they are venal, that they are evil, wicked. It's a very, very ancient trope of the wicked witch. I do remember that was one of them, and I was very proud of that piece, and I hadn't seen anyone else do it.
No, sounds great.
That was for the Saturday paper.
Yeah. It's great to actually reveal it on those terms. And career low?
Well, it probably was that time I got fired from the palace. That was pretty confronting. Oh, no, actually, I think my career low was probably the first 2 or 3 years out of university, when I had a whole bunch of shit-kicker jobs in marketing departments and advertising agencies that I was uniformly shit-ass at. And I'm not being modest, I was shit-ass at them. I couldn't understand the language that was being used in advertising. It was heavily technical, and I can remember feeling very much, I was a sort of junior, and I was working for this quite emotionally unstable bloke. And he would say things to me like, can you go and ask Peter, the production manager, about the herny hern for the hern schnurt and better get. That's what it sounded like to me. And I would try to remember that, and I would go to Peter and I'd say, Stephen wants to know about the herny collision at the blurt schnurt. And he'd say, but what about the glingle? What about the glingle? I haven't got the glingle. And so I'd go back to Peter and say, he says he hasn't got the glingle and he hasn't got, can't do it without the glingle. No, he's got the glingle. He hasn't got the, you know, and I just, everyone would yell at me. I didn't know what they were talking about. And I was useless. I was depressed and I was bored and I was miserable and I hated it. And that would be pretty much my first 3 years.
And then you found writing after that, though. And
then I found writing. Yeah. And it was so hard to get into. But in a way, again, it's really interesting you asking me these questions, because that low, that desperation, that feeling, if I don't find something I really want to do, I'm going to just give up and have babies and work in a sandwich shop, was what made me desperate enough to keep knocking on doors to try and get a junior copywriter's job, even though there were no women practically anywhere in that. I just kept knocking on doors until I got someone to give me a chance, and eventually I did. But it was the desperate desire to get out of those shit-ass jobs that I was new. I was not cut out for that. Admin is not my thing. I'm no good at it. That gave me the motivation to get the job that eventually I did turn out to have some ability to do. So it's funny, isn't it? The low is almost always.
It's a familiar story to me that, yeah, that when you're a writer, you're not really good at other stuff. It's so interesting.
I now say to people, if they want me to be on boards and things, I say, look, I'll do it, but I'm no good at the admin. I can't read a profit and loss sheet. I can't do any of that. Mm. I'll be helpful on the marketing, the people side, and if you give me a job to do, I'll do it. But I'm no good at the tick the boxes, governance.
Mm.
I'm no good at it. Just be warned.
I'll probably say the wrong thing in a public forum.
Yeah. Oh, there's no doubt. You just have to live with that.
That's right.
Some people like that.
Final question. Do you have a motto?
Don't anticipate. It probably is actually something along the lines of, it's those three lines.
Yeah.
There's nothing special about you. There's nothing special. Terrible things can happen. They can happen to anyone. Safety is an illusion. Danger is reality. It's that. It's that I go back to time after time. If I'm feeling terrible, I feel cheated, or I haven't got what I thought I should get, I go back to those three lines. What makes you so special? Why should things go well for you? They don't necessarily for anyone. Just, you know, stop being self-indulgent and do the next thing.
I love it because it deletes ego from the equation. It's great.
Yeah. I've got a healthy ego, but I do think I get myself back together when I get ego out of the equation. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, same. It's actually a relief to get rid of it sometimes.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. It's a relief to recognize, I think, too, where you stop and the rest of the world begins,
mm-hmm,
which is what that tells you. It says, you know, you're just, I keep saying to people, you know, we're clinging to a rock that's hurtling through space, and the only way off is to die.
Mm.
That is the reality of life. And gee, I wish the anti-vaxxers would realize that, because they are becoming putty in the hands of the most dangerous people on this planet at the moment, the far right.
Yeah.
And they are letting, by desperately wanting control, we're desperately wanting the illusion of safety.
Yeah.
They're actually putting not just themselves, but everybody else in terrible danger.
Thank you so much for tuning in to 10 Questions. If you'd like to subscribe to us on Patreon, we're at 10 Questions with Adam Zwar, and that's where you can get the bonus content on every interview. Until next time, thanks for joining us.